Hey, listeners, please support the Business of Pharmacy podcast by checking out our sponsors at bizoffarmpod.com. That link is in the description. You're listening to the Business of Pharmacy podcast with me, your host, Mike Kelzer. Mike, for those that haven't come across you online, introduce yourself and tell our listeners what we're talking about today.
My name is Mike Zaccaro. I am the head of strategic execution at Pharma Logistics, and we're here today to talk about pharmaceutical reverse distribution.
Mike, in independent pharmacy, we have listeners from different walks, but let's say that a good chunk is from there. We hate pharmacy benefit managers. Just can't stand them, the way they pressure us and things like that. Is there anybody on your side, in your industry, is there anybody you hate?
Well, that's an interesting question. What I would say is this. It's the manufacturers, if you will, that don't have liberal return goods policies. Those manufacturers that make it difficult for us or for our clients to recover credit for their expired goods. And so anybody that delays that process or makes that more difficult, it simply makes it more challenging for us and more difficult for our customers to put dollars back into their pockets. I would certainly say also we have to work directly with a lot of manufacturers from different processing components. They have different rules, different regulations. The ones that make it complicated, the ones that don't meet us in the middle, the ones that don't see us as there for our mutual customers who are the pharmacies and see us as kind of a thorn in their side, those are the ones that I'd rather not wake up and deal with. But by and large, there's a lot of good players, and the industry has come a long way into recognizing the value that reverse distribution provides in the pharmacy space.
Do you think the ones that it's difficult, do you think they do that on purpose to not have to pay back right away?
My honest assessment is no, I really don't. I just don't believe that reverse distribution or expired pharmaceutical processing at a manufacturer gets the attention it deserves. For us, it's all that we do, right? This is for 27 years, this is all I've known. I wake up every day and go to bed every day and thinking about expired goods is what I do. I think for most manufacturers, reverse distribution is not core to their business. And it's not the number one thing that they wake up putting resource or energy into. And I don't think it gets a lot of time and attention from the CEO at a big pharma company to pay attention to returns. Now, the people that work in those departments and the people that work for those companies that are directly involved, there's some really good people that work really hard to get it right. I just don't think it's a core focus for a lot of manufacturers.
When you talk about the people from the different manufacturers, are these kind of faceless names? You're just trying to get in where you can as far as problems and issues and things like that?
Yeah, I think that's pretty fair. I would say that we've got a team here that works specifically with credit reconciliation and manufacturer policies. And those individuals work hard to forge relationships with individuals at the manufacturers so that we can stay current and stay on top of manufacturer changes, policy changes, dollar amount reimbursements, any of those things. And so those relationships are important. With that being said, a lot of them are transactional. A lot of them are kind of collections oriented. And the strategic thinkers, the people who are setting policies, the people who are setting reimbursement policies aren't necessarily the ones that we're dealing with on a day in and day out basis. There's numerous things that we would change if we could. But by and large, our reconciliation department works hard to forge relationships at both manufacturers and wholesalers to make the process easier.
All right, Mike, you've got a lot less gray hair than I do, but you've got some, and that means you've got employees. Let's face it. Take me through the business. How many people do you have on site, and what's the breakdown as far as people who are actually touching the product versus people at the computer desk, that kind of thing? What's your breakdown as far as rough numbers?
Sure. Total headcount is about 170 farmers. We don't refer to our staff here as employees. We refer to everybody as farmers. PHARMERS. So about 170 in total. We've got roughly 40 out in the field. These are our field service representatives, really the front line of our organization. So we have customers, primarily our hospital customers, but also a lot of retail pharmacy customers who use what we call our on-site service. And we have field service representatives scattered across the country, as well as internationally. We've got a service rep in Japan and a service representative in Germany. The Germany and Japan representative are for our Department of Defense customers, and that's our biggest customer right now. So anywhere we have a military treatment facility, we have field service.
Wow.
The other 38 are scattered throughout the United States, and they're deployed home-based to our customers to help start the returns process. And again, we've got about 40 of those individuals in total from that department. When you come back into the fulfillment center, we've got roughly 50 that work in the fulfillment center. So these are the individuals that are going to induct the product, capture the NDC lot expiration date, do all of the processing in our fulfillment center. We then have a credit reconciliation department made up of about 5 individuals. They set manufacturer policies, do all the credit reimbursement, accounting and finance, a big chunk of important stuff that we do here. We've got about 6 people in that department. Got a sales staff of 12 individuals right now that are out there bringing in new customers and adding new customers, a customer service department of a couple of individuals. We have heads of all of these departments as well. So I have a total of 9 direct reports that come to me. So the head of fulfillment, the head of reconciliations, the head of service, all of the department heads report into me. And culture and team, we've got 3 individuals that work in that department. I'm feeling like I'm leaving some out, but all in all, about 170.
Right now, you have 9 people coming to you. Is there ever a time where you're going to put another layer between that so you have 1 person coming to you and they get the pleasure of dealing with the 9?
Truth be told, I have most of my work coming through me and most of my work down to that team going through our chief operating officer. So for really 4 days and call it 5 hours a week, I have 1 direct report. But every Monday, today is Monday, I have 1 big meeting with my entire team and all of those direct reports. So I basically run the organization on 1 meeting a week with my entire team. We discuss the top accomplishment from the previous week, their top priority for the current week, what it is that they have as a hot topic that they want to address for the benefit of the team. We process those issues during that meeting. We create an agenda and attack plan for the rest of the week. And then my chief operating officer goes about managing the day-to-day and working with those individuals. I really do see my direct reports only once a week and spend a good portion of my time working on the business and not in the business. And that's been a very beneficial piece of the company's growth. And quite frankly, my chief operating officer does it extremely well.
What mentors, whether it be books or schooling or other leaders, have you followed in order to be working on the business versus in and keeping that structured and tasked out? All the things you were talking about that made a hell of a lot of sense to me.
One book that I read early on in my career that really kind of set the stage for the need to establish systems and processes is a book called The E-Myth.
Michael Gerber. Great book.
There you go. Great book. So that talks all about the need to established systems and processes, and why just because you're good at a particular skill set doesn't mean that you know how to run a business. That was one piece that really stuck with me. I'm a pretty avid reader about business books in general, but I will also tell you that the one piece that was really critical for me in my growth and in building out the company were 2 things. Early on, I think one of the things I did well was knowing what I didn't know. And even when I first started the company, I was already working with a consultant who had been there, done that. I did not attend college. I did not have a direct mentor in my career. I was self-taught in many ways, but I engaged this consultant early on, and he was pretty instrumental in the first couple of years. And then a real big catalyst for me and continue to work with this group indirectly and also maintain great friendships with the rest of the group is I joined a peer-to-peer networking group called Vistage. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with Vistage, but Vistage is an organization that has chapters all across the globe. I think the Chicago area has 3 or 4 of them. It's a group of CEOs, generally similarly sized businesses that meet once per month. And it's almost an informal board of directors. And what I've learned in that regard is whether you're in pharmaceutical reverse distribution, trucking, printing supplies, business is business. And the challenges that we have are the same across the board. And so we would go into these meetings and you'd meet once a month and you're allowed to bring issues and bring topics. Hey, I'm having a struggle with sales. How can the group help? Hey, I'm having a struggle with culture and team. I'm dealing with this issue. What do we need to do? And you're learning from literally your peers. And one of the things that entrepreneurs lack in their own company is the ability to hear from their peers. You're always hearing from somebody who reports to you. Going out and getting that feedback from other peers who have no vested interest other than seeing you succeed has been invaluable to me. And I did that for close to 5 years in Vistage. I joined another peer group since then. And I still see a number of those members on a every other month basis. We kind of did our own spinoff of it and continue to meet for those kinds of sessions.
I think probably a ton of people would say, no, Mike, that's good, but we're different. Our business is different. We've got Sally in accounting and Bill over here, and we're different. It's like, no, you're not different. You're different maybe in the dotting the I's and crossing the T's down in the bottom part, but people are people, and pretty much businesses are businesses.
I completely agree. The names and faces are different. The challenges are really the same. And I think that was a big takeaway for me after joining that group and being in it for a few months. The reality is, as business owners, we all are dealing with the same challenges. The names and faces changes. It's the same issues.
A lot of times when you think about a business, especially for maybe pharmacists who are trying to break off a little bit, I think a lot of people kind of look from the top down and they get freaked out. And I think that a lot of businesses can start from the ground up and it's solving a problem. You guys obviously solve a problem. If you could look at the psychology behind what you solve, what do you think you're giving people with your service?
I think it's included really in the brand promise that we deliver for our customers. And if you take a look at our logo underneath it, you're going to see three things: clean, comply, collect. And those are the three things that we really focus on. So when we've interviewed customers, when we've talked to customers, when we've asked them, hey, when you're looking at selecting a reverse distribution company, or when you choose to work with Pharma Logistics, what are the things that you're looking for? And those are the three things that our customers came back to us and said, this is what we want. So the first piece is the clean component. They have these expired goods. They're generally sitting in a box underneath the counter or off in the corner or somewhere where it's just accumulating. In many ways, it's kind of garbage in their eyes, right?
It's garbage and it's guilt. Like, I should be doing something with it.
Sure. So the one piece that we provide for our customers is that clean component. We're going to give them the opportunity to clean that out either by them shipping it to us or by us sending a service representative in to pick it up. The second piece that they're looking for, and this is especially true in when you're talking about controlled substances and DEA regulations and state regulations, is the compliance component. There's a lot of rules, a lot of regulations. There's a lot of what you can and can't do when it comes to shipping product or disposing a product. And nobody wants to be in a non-compliant situation. So they look for us to be the expert there on EPA waste. They look for us to be the expert there on DEA rules and regulations. And they want to make sure that we keep them compliant. And then the third bucket, and everybody has a priority depending on where they're at in the service cycle, but the third component and where we really separate from our competition is in the third piece, which is the collect function. And that's for us really where the rubber hits the road. How much dollars, how many products can we get credit back for? How quickly can we get that money back into our budgets? And how are you going to help us do that? So those are really, for us, the three pieces that we see.
When you think about the manufacturers and their response when you're collecting and so on, I suppose it's all relative. It's like if nobody allowed it, you would say, well, that's all relative. But if someone was real good and someone else was bad, now you've got a scale to compare. The companies that you think are not real friendly to the pharmacist slash you guys, what kind of things are you seeing that are not as lax as compared to a company that you think is better? And I mean better, like giving more money back. What are some companies doing? And do you think it's smart they're doing it? Do you think it's fair?
Yeah, well, I'll start with this. I would say that certainly manufacturers can create competitive advantage and can create good service for their customers by providing a fair and reasonable return goods policy. I'm certainly not advocating for nor expecting manufacturers to simply say, hey, look, everything that you do, no matter what you do, it's not a everything should be returnable component. We're certainly not expecting that. What can be done, and the ones that get it right, are the ones that have a very clear, a very specific return goods policy. They have one that's fair and reasonable. It's not complex. And then they commit the resource to it behind the scenes to actually see it through. I mean, we see manufacturers that are able to receive and process a return goods authorization sometimes in 24 hours. And then we see others that take close to 60 days just to send the return goods authorization to get it back to us. We can't even start the returns process until, in many instances, we get that return goods authorization, right? So I think being fair and reasonable with their customers is the starting point. And then having policies that are clear, clean, concise also helps in the process.
It just seems to me like when you manufacture things, people are going to return them. It's not some oddity. Like, what are you going to do in an earthquake if you're a manufacturer in Michigan or something like that? It's not an oddity. It just seems like they would have that more set up. They're obviously going to get returns.
I look at it very much on the bell curve. I think if I'm to assess it, I think 20% of the manufacturers are really good at it. I think 20% of the manufacturers understand it. They grasp what you just said. Hey, we're going to get it. It's good customer service. It's a way to separate, right? I think you've got 20% of the manufacturers that just for various reasons don't put the time, effort, and energy into it. And they're not the ones that make it easy for their customers or easy for us. And then I think about 60% of them fall somewhere in the middle, depending on how busy they are, depending on what cycle they're in, depending on if they're getting a lot of volume of returns or not, you're going to see them fall in some category, one or the other. By and large, we work well with our manufacturers, with all of the companies to recover credits from them. There are simply some that are better than others.
On the other hand, pharmacists are kind of a captive audience. Like most of the pharmacies, they have the brand name. It's like they're not going to say to a customer, no, we're not going to fill this strength of this because this manufacturer doesn't return to us very well. It seems like that service is pretty far removed and their hands are almost tied that they're going to do it. Now, with generics, maybe, because you have maybe different companies that you can choose from, but the brand names, I guess they don't have a real great reason to separate themselves because of the captive audience.
I think that's in part true. I think the other piece to consider is that there's a lot of products that treat the same disease state. One of the things that we're looking to move into is empowering our customers to be able to make decisions based on return goods policy. So we think that ultimately evaluating a manufacturer's return goods policy is a good piece to evaluate when it comes to whether it should be in your formulary or not.
Yeah, true.
If you think about a P&T committee in a hospital situation, the nurses are going to weigh in, the doctors are going to weigh in, the pharmacist is going to weigh in. We think there's value in having reverse distribution, or at least the data associated with reverse distribution, weigh in as well. If there's going to be a tiebreaker, it might as well be the one that if it expires, we're going to get money back for it.
Mike, do you have to, I'm just going to throw some initials out, DSCA something or other with all the following of the barcodes and the QR codes and all that kind of stuff. Does that continue through to you?
We're certainly going to see it. We certainly have to be internally have the technology to be able to process those labels and to be able to scan those labels. And quite frankly, in many areas, it's going to make it easier. You're now going to have one scan that will include NDC number, lot number, expiration date, and an individual license plate. Right now, those are multiple points of entry. And so in many ways, that's going to be simplified. We technically fall outside of compliance, the rules and regulations when it comes to those end at reverse distribution. But we actually think it's, a really excellent way for the industry to morph into more effective and better inventory management. Being able to understand where the product was sold and ultimately where it ended down to the individual product level We think there's a good opportunity for our customers to even better manage their inventory with that information.
Now that, Mike, your company is built up, and sometimes to build a company, you've got to take a certain path. Is there any other direction that you wish you would have done earlier or a different road? Like my house, we built our house in 2002, and you should see all the damn cables I got in my basement. You know, there's 50 of these cables coming in to different rooms and so on for the cable TV and the, you know, computer, the Cat 5s and all those things. And it's like, the only room I need these really in are the two rooms that we didn't put them in. So I walk back there and I see dollar signs. And of course, you don't need it now because of Wi-Fi and so on. If I could have done it over, I wouldn't have done all that. But is there any direction that you kind of wish you would have gone? Or because you're there all the time and meeting with your team and so on, that you could be nimble enough to adjust all the way through from the beginning?
You know, it really is an excellent question, and I think one that's difficult to answer because it's easy to think about what you would have done when, you know, when all the cards come out, right? It's easy to say, oh, I should have bet more when the river card comes out and it comes in your favor. With that being said, I will tell you that we organizationally had to make some pretty difficult and serious decisions over the last several years to make sure that we continued to put ourselves in a good position to take advantage of future opportunities. And so, speaking a little bit to that, we really did three things over the last 3.5 years to put us in a better position on a go-forward basis. One is we had moved 4 times in the history of the organization. Started out of the basement of my house in about 700 square feet, and in June of 2019, broke ground on a brand new warehouse and about 124,000 square feet of total space, about 75,000 square feet of current processing space. And that was really important because the bigger we got, the more disruptive those moves became. And shifting all of those licenses and getting people to go to a different facility, and you lose some if you move too far. So that was a big piece. We had to build out that brick and mortar. The other thing that we had to do is, again, thinking about what we wanted to be when we grew up. We could no longer be as manual as we were. If you would have seen our operation 4 years ago, it looked exactly like it did when I was operating out of my basement, except we just had more people doing it. And that didn't work. It certainly was efficient. But, you know, I talked about the number of farmers that we have now. We're at 170, and we're up about 25% over the last 4 years in terms of customer base. And we're doing it with a lot less farmers than we had originally planned because of that automation. And so that was important. We knew if we wanted to continue to expand our service footprint, we had to do the automation. And then the final piece was the tech stack that we had deployed. We were really good at managing our IT spend over 25 plus years, but as you can imagine, accumulated a tremendous amount of technology debt that had to be repaid. And so we had to literally do a build or buy decision on every single piece of technology that we have inside of our four walls, as well as what we have out in the field, and flipped a switch on that about 14 months ago. And so what we've really got now is established the brick and mortar. We did the automation and brought in the tech stack as well. And so we're now positioned for the future and positioned to make those decisions. Those were not forward-looking decisions that I made for the first 20 years of the organization, but were the decisions that I was able to make as I moved myself into a position where I could think on the business and not in the business.
What is a technology that you maybe drool over a little bit, whether it's AI to do something or some robotic arms to do this or that?
You touched on two of them, right? So we're certainly looking at AI and what impact that could have on our space. And quite frankly, that's really in its infancy for where we're looking at it. But we've already brought in robotic processing automation in a couple of different fronts. We've talked a little bit about return goods authorizations. Our farmers are highly skilled and excellent at doing fulfillment work, and we want them working on higher value, more important things. We're not looking to do it with less of them. We're looking to deploy their resource on more value-added functions. And so the process of having a farmer sit in front of a computer and key in addresses and DEA numbers and information over and over again for 8 hours was something that we did away with by bringing in robotic processing automation, which now does that automatically. And it runs 24/7 and allows that individual to focus more on areas that they can provide more value to our clients. So that's a big one. We continue to see the opportunity now that we've created this tech stack that we have to really deploy this solution inside a pharmacy and inside a pharmacy management tool. So again, we're really looking to give our customers cradle to grave when it comes to pharmaceutical products right now. And expired goods have traditionally been that black hole in inventory management. What am I losing? What's going out the door? Can I track it back to where it was purchased? That doesn't exist right now. And we're looking to move into that space as well. We've deployed the automation and technology inside our warehouse in three phases. We're through two phases of it. What we're focused on internally in those first couple of phases was really eliminating the number of touches that our farmers had to have on a particular product. And so bringing in a conveyance system, bringing in scanning capabilities, bringing in the ability to capture images of product and the weights of product. A big piece of what we focused on was when we process returns for customers, how can we ensure that our customers are getting back the dollar amounts that we expect them to get back? And what are the reasons those credits are being denied? And typically those came back as, we don't believe that the package size was correct. We don't believe that the quantity was correct. We don't have a proof of delivery. So we've automated a good chunk of that. And that's eliminated the challenge that we have in obtaining some of those credits for our customers. So that's really helped. You see some instances of, and it's down the road, quite frankly, not a focus for us because we're really not a fulfillment center in the sense of like an Amazon. But you look at automated forklifts and automatic material handling, is there the possibility? Yeah, we're not super focused on that piece. We're really focused on how can we capture as much of the data integrity on the item as possible and ensure that data integrity is maintained throughout the reverse distribution process so that our customers can ultimately collect the dollars that we believe that they're owed.
Do you see any blockchain in the future? And here's why I ask. I was talking to one of my guests about blockchain, and they were just saying that for these long things that happen A to Z, and they were talking about drug trials, and they said it was so important there because if person B enters their weight as 270, that's pretty big. Let's say 170. It must be getting dinner time. If someone there says 170, but by the time it gets to the end, it's like 107, something got inverted. It really messes up the trial. I know I brought up those initials that I'm sure I botched earlier, but will that be something where, or maybe it's already been handled with this QR code? Is that going to be something that you can actually blockchain it to see exactly where something is?
I'm not the expert on the whole blockchain piece and that element of technology. What I can say is the Drug Supply Chain Security Act, DSCSA, is creating or has created for the first time an individual license plate for every item. If you think about it before, a manufacturer would have a production run. They'd spit out 10,000 bottles a day, and all of that would be lot number 1, 2, 3. Now what you're going to have are 10,000 units produced, and each of those 10,000 units is going to have its own license plate.
Really? Wow.
Yes. And so that gives you really what you just described. It doesn't have the blockchain component, as sure. You mentioned, but it does give you the ability to track that product more completely. And really, that was the whole point of it.
You mentioned with AI and those sorts of things not affecting the workforce as far as numbers go. And that's so true. It's like, just with this podcast, for example, it used to be that, Mike, after you and I talked, my show notes would be Mike and Mike talked. Show notes I don't think are as important as people think, and so on. Now I can use AI to improve that, but it's not taking me any more time. I had to write Mike Talks to Mike. That's the same amount of time it takes me to put the transcript into AI and say, give me a show note. It's the same amount of time, same amount of human time, but the product is that much better.
I totally agree. We're relatively new, as are most organizations, into using features like ChatGPT and seeing how that's impacting things. But what we have found internally, and as we continue to look at ways to integrate it, it's really what you just described. It's an opportunity for us to make things more efficient and allowing individuals to spend time on more value-added work. Mm-hmm. And look, we don't believe that there's any shortage of value-added work. We believe there's a lot of time and effort that goes into redundant, non-value-added type functions. And AI is really doing a nice job of being mm-hmm. able to eliminate those types of things. Even meetings that we now have, we'll put on the transcribe feature.
Yeah.
And as opposed to somebody having to sit there and take notes. If you're taking notes, you're not paying attention. And so if you have it recording,
right,
you can just have that dialogue, be really engaged. That ultimately creates better thought flow and better creative ideas. And you're still going to end up with the same result at the end, quite frankly, better, because I could read them.
Yeah, that's amazing. I was talking to one of the guests and I forget what it was. It was a similar thing with a board meeting. And I said, is it just a bunch of people sitting around or is it official where you've got a transcriber and you can't call them secretaries anymore. What do you call them? Executive assistants or something like that. And within a few months, that's a moot point. Just put on the recording and get a transcript of it.
You got it. You got it.
Mike, if you came into work today, and for some reason, it's 2033 versus 2023, 10 years later, what would shock you about your business? I'm basically talking technology and ideas that are out 10 years, not just marching year by year. What do you think would shock you the most coming in 10 years later?
Yeah, well, I don't know that I would be shocked necessarily, but what I would tell you is the direction that it's going and the direction, quite frankly, that it needs to get into, and industries have been at this for a while, is just better analysis of the why when it comes to expired pharmaceuticals. What is the reason that this product is expiring? Pre-COVID, I would argue that health systems were not as focused on every single corner of a hospital's expense. And since then, there's no stone that's getting left unturned. And making sure that they are paying attention to that spend and making sure that they're paying attention to those credits are things that we're having conversations with customers all the time. And it's really shifted in that regard. So we again think that the shift that we made towards the enterprise level data systems that we have will ultimately allow us to play a critical role in how pharmacies are setting formulary and how pharmacies are ultimately managing inventory. And we think the function that we provide will be integrated with those. And in terms of what else it will look like in 10 years, our investment into those areas, automation, technology, and brick and mortar, are allowing us to pursue customers that we could not pursue previously. So we certainly think we're going to be servicing larger and larger customers with greater and greater volumes and more efficiency. I think the accuracy will continue to get better. One of the things that prevents reverse distribution from being as automated as forward distribution is we're dealing with product that's already been handled. So you're dealing with barcodes that might be nicked, or you're dealing with stickers that might be over a barcode, or you're dealing with a damaged product, right? We think that there will be technology that continues to evolve that will allow optical character recognition or will allow those types of images to still be captured and connect the dots, much the way that AI is completing your thoughts right now in an email. We think those are going to be things that are going to be able to happen from a processing perspective as well.
You brought up about keeping expired products down to start with. When I hear that as a pharmacist, the future of pharmacy is that pharmacists get remunerated for not dispensing medicine, by not having someone take so much, where now you only get a profit when you sell something. When you get to that point more and more of helping the products not to expire in the first place, is there any revenue in that? Would that be some kind of a consulting thing, or are you just doing it to stay competitive and losing that revenue stream?
People ask me, if that's where it's going, aren't you putting yourself out of business? And this is what I would say. You've got to figure out where the industry is going, and you can bury your head in the sand all you want about where it's going and say, well, it's always going to happen. Now, this is what I would say. I think expired goods aren't going anywhere. I think expired pharmaceuticals will continue to happen for all kinds of reasons. Drug recalls will continue to happen for all kinds of reasons. The need for reverse distribution isn't going away. I would also tell you that the business model for us includes, as we continue to get better, is continuing to use the technology and the data that we have to better manage the inventory and to then begin providing that software as a solution to customers. And so if you're processing $100,000 worth of expired goods, and we can show you how to reduce that down to 50, but then we're going to bill you for a subscription service that shows you how to do it, that's one of the ways that we see the industry and, quite frankly, us being sustainable. With that being said, there is volumes of expired goods continue to be the same. We continue to see the products come in. We're not seeing fewer and fewer products come in. So we're not worried about it from a sustainability perspective, but it does make sense for us to partner more closely with our pharmacies. And as we're perhaps losing margin on one side, to be able to continue to demonstrate value, but to bill for it on the backside. And my feeling is that customers want us to earn a fair and reasonable profit. And we think everybody should earn a fair and reasonable profit. And so paying for those services and using different services to accomplish the same result, we think, is possible by helping to manage inventory and process expired goods.
We're not with a wholesaler anymore because once you stop buying brand names, you're not invited really to the table. It seems to me there was something said that if you're not buying from a big wholesaler, you can't return goods bought unless you go through a wholesaler. Maybe that was it. You have to somehow go through the wholesaler. Do you recall that? Is that old fashioned? What might I be remembering there?
Yeah, a lot of this comes down to manufacturer return goods policies and ultimately how that credit flows and how the manufacturer wants the credit to flow in those situations.
Gotcha.
And so generally speaking, the majority of our customers are going to be using one of the big three. They're certainly using some of the smaller wholesalers as well, but the manufacturers have to have a way to issue the credit to those wholesalers. And if they don't have a way to issue credit to those wholesalers, then they're going to deny those credits to be issued to begin with. So really, this is driven by manufacturer policy. A lot of times what you'll see, and this does dictate a lot of returnability or non-returnability, particularly at the independent level, is products bought on the secondary market or products bought from a non-primary wholesaler, which are actually sold without return goods privileges because they're sold at a discount because they're short dated to begin with. And so those will be sold on a non-returnable basis. And a lot of times those are secondary wholesalers that are providing that opportunity. Because a lot of the bigger wholesalers, their agreements with manufacturers are not getting anything that has less than 12 or 24 months worth of shelf life to begin with. And secondary wholesalers, they get a good chunk of that.
It's coming back to me now because, yes, if you return, let's say there's $1,000 that the manufacturer owes you, they don't cut you a check. They want to reimburse through the wholesaler and the wholesaler credit you kind of thing.
You got it. You got it. Now that's morphed itself a couple of ways. And again, I've been at this for 27 years, but that's morphed itself a lot. But generally speaking, the credits are initially issued to the wholesaler. And that's a big piece of what drives that policy.
Yep. All right, Mike, I know you're a positive guy and I know you got things set up well, but there's got to be one day a week or one day a month where you say, ah, crap, I got to do that today, or I got to do that this week. Is there anything like that?
Sure. This is what I would say, what that looks like from my perspective. There's a lot of things that I get excited about on a Sunday night that get me motivated to get into work. And then there are those things that drive me nuts. Here's my number one thing that I don't like doing, fixing the same problem the second time around.
There you go.
It is extremely frustrating for me to process an issue, to create the solution, to create the system and process, to then find out that 3 months later, we've kind of lost our way a little bit and we have to go back and do that. And so one of the things that we've done fairly recently is added a head of continuous improvement to our executive management team to actually do away with that. Doug Glass came to us from Motorola, big Six Sigma background, and this is what he does all day, every day, is work on continuous improvement. It got to be such a pain point for me, Mike, that I finally had to hire a guy to help take that pain away from us. And Doug is doing a great job with it and helping us eliminate those types of things. I think that to me is the biggest challenge. I would also say this, I'm at my level really blessed to have a really good team underneath me. And so a lot of the day-to-day and a lot of the working in the business is handled by a lot of staff. But back in the day, when I was doing a lot of it myself, accounting and finance, that was not my jam.
Yeah,
the numbers and the ledgers and the balancing, that's not what got me up in the morning. I love solving problems. I love fixing things.
Yep.
I love operational focus. I love figuring out how we can do things in fewer steps and how we can be more efficient. Those excite me. But when I was working more day to day, the accounting and finance, not my strong suit, and repetitive problems that we don't fix right the first time are my two biggest frustrations.
Well, that's what Gerber was saying in his book that we mentioned earlier, The E-Myth, especially for new people in the business. And in order to both grow, but also maybe not to go crazy, you might be wearing 12 hats or 20 hats, but his method would be to at least name all those hats, but at least say, all right, someday when I'm big enough, I'm going to do this. But right now I'm the VP of cleaning the bathroom or the VP of this or that.
For sure. And we've really adopted that and carried that forward. So you're at 170 employees, we're still a very small company by and large, right? In the reverse distribution space, we're arguably the second largest reverse distributor. But in terms of company size, 170 employees is still relatively small. And so because of that, we still have a lot of leaders at the executive level that have what we call a role, and then they wear a hat. So you have your primary focus. So as an example, Joel, and that's our head of fulfillment, and that's his primary role. He also wears the hat of compliance, and he has a compliance team that reports into him. In a future state, as the company continues to grow, that's a spot in the org chart that somebody will ultimately assume. But for right now, he wears a hat, and then he also has a role.
What other new roles are there, let's say, in maybe bigger companies? Are there other board spots or people like that that you would dream about or bring in if you had the room for it and so on?
A really good question. We think about it organizationally is that it starts first with structure and then people. So as opposed to first focusing on what's wrong with or why are we not getting such and so input, the first question that we always ask ourselves is, do we have the correct structure in place? Do we have the right environment for people to succeed there? And generally speaking, once we solve for the structure, slotting the right person in there becomes second nature and works very well. So I would say a big thing for us is starting first with structure and then with people. With that being said, right now, we identified an opportunity to improve the organization by adding, it depends on the industry, some people call it customer success, other people call it account management. We've traditionally had field service, customer service, and sales. And what we realized is that structure isn't allowing us to work as close with our customers as we'd like it to be. We're not spending enough time with our customers right now, really understanding the challenges that are happening in their pharmacies and what they're being asked to do. We're providing good service and we're providing good field service and we're being responsive and we're delivering on expectations. But having a conversation with a system director of pharmacy at a hospital and asking him, what are the strategic initiatives that you're working on in your pharmacy over the next 12 to 24 months? Yeah. And how can we help?
Yep.
Is something where we want to be. So the one piece that I would say that we're looking to add to the structure right now is that account management role. And these are going to be people who are really focused on going deep. They're going to have the ability to go a mile deep and 6 inches wide with every customer.
Yeah.
And understanding what the opportunity is for us to better support them with what we do. We think that's a piece that's been missing. I think it's a piece that we can improve on. So that's one that's coming.
From my side, I'm seeing the customers as some old guy like me who's got the dusty box in the corner kind of thing. But as you said, your customers run the gamut. I mean, you've got some really big accounts, and having that to go deeper seems like a good idea.
I totally agree. And our customer base is spread out across the board from really small physicians' offices all the way up to, as I mentioned, the Department of Defense is arguably in terms of geography and arguably customer size as well. Number of locations are our biggest customer, and then everything in between. And so we have to be able to provide the service to suit all of those customers. And as we continue to grow and as we continue to expand service offerings to include other classes of trade, those skills are going to be more and more important for us. And again, different strokes for different folks. A large chain doesn't have the same needs as a small compounding pharmacy, as does a small veterinary hospital. And it's being able to understand the world that those customers live in and be able to deliver the service that they're looking for is what we're looking to do as we continue to grow.
Mike, do you ever see a need? Well, probably the best way to explain it would be like GM. They've got the, I don't even know the names of them, but they got the Corvette for this kind of person, and they've got the van for this kind of person. I can't think of all the different brands they have in there. Would there ever come a point for you where you would think that you would need to rebrand a part of your business and not even associated with your name, not to hide it, but it's its own brand and people don't even know it's related? And what market level might that be if there was such a thing?
That's a really interesting question, and I appreciate you asking it. And we don't necessarily see that happening at the brand level. We think really everything is pharma logistics and can fit into pharma. With that being said, we absolutely do believe in creating specific solutions for the various classes of trade and creating solutions that can do that. I'll give you a very recent example of us doing that. So we had provided a lot of service to the veterans health hospitals across the country for many years. And for a lot of reasons, that contract has not been reissued, and a lot of those customers are still looking for solutions. And so we invested in Doug, our continuous improvement guy, came in and said, let's take a look at what they're looking for. And we took recommendations from the PBM, and we took guidance from the VHA directive, and we took guidance from the OIG report, and we created a solution that checked off literally all of the challenges that VA had, which were very specific to the VA. They don't operate, all hospitals are different, but the government facilities have different ways to contract, they have different ways of credit to be issued. And so we created a very specific program designed specifically for the VA. It's our VA drug liquidation program. And it's an opportunity for us to help them. They're taking product right now and disposing of it as opposed to returning it for credit. And there's a lot of reasons for that, but our solution has solved for that. So if you think about the hotel chains, Marriott's got the Bonvoy label, and then everything underneath that is a Marriott. We see Pharma Logistics as being the overarching brand, but us creating very specific service components for individual classes of trade and branding those separately.
Yeah, you've got the long confidence of the company, and then you can individualize with the different targets and almost have little logos for the department thing, but they all know it's part of this bigger thing.
For sure. I think that's more the direction that we're headed as opposed to creating a separate hotel chain, if you will.
Mike, tell me about your think time. Now, maybe it's just in the shower or driving into work or something, but do you have structure for that? Do you have little signs on your door to say, this is Mike's think time? Do you plan this? And if so, how?
Again, great question. And I'm blessed to have a really good team underneath me. And I do structure that time as much as I can. Again, I run the organization these days on one meeting a week, Monday morning from 9 to 12:30. And that really allows me the rest of the week to spend thinking about the business and not working in the business. Now, of course, things happen. And of course, I'm going to make sure that I'm available. A couple of things that I do. I tell everybody that I have an open door policy, which is only partly true. What it means for me is my door is always open, but you got to schedule it. So I don't take random meetings throughout the day. I ask people to come to me with the important stuff, not the urgent stuff. The urgent stuff can wait. Bring me the important stuff.
Kind of the different quadrant.
You bet. You bet. And so that allows me to do that. I would also say I'm a big believer in people in my role not having to make a million small decisions, that if I make one or two really big decisions a year, those are the ones that we need to be able to get behind. I tell everybody, my job is to figure out what we're going to be when we grow up. And I can't be doing that if I'm constantly thinking about tying my shoes. And so I have a good chunk of time to do that, a great team, a lot of structure behind it to support that. And that has allowed me to do it. I also told you about the peer groups that I'm a part of.
Yeah.
And really, I find myself looking to spend time with other entrepreneurs and other business owners as much as possible in disparate industries,
mm-hmm.
because the types of conversations and the type of information that comes from there, I can almost always bring something back into my organization and implement it. My team, as an example, used to hate Wednesdays because Tuesdays were my Vistage meetings. And so they knew every Wednesday when I showed back up, there was going to be something new that I picked up on that we were going to start working on.
Oh, my dad, God rest his soul, but I was fairly organized compared to him. And so my thought time was during the week. I'd come in Monday, I'd have a list of things to think about through the week, and I would give myself some goals and so on. His think time was Sunday. You can imagine what Monday morning was like for me when you're busy as hell in the pharmacy and his think day was Sunday and my think day is not going to start till about Tuesday. It was really something. All right, so Mike, I got to go deeper though. Sketch this out for me. If you had a great idea, I know it's a lot of different things, but if you had a great idea, would you be sitting at your desk with the door closed and your hands back behind your head and an idea comes to you? Would you be on a bike ride? Would you be talking to somebody else? If you could think of a real great idea, physically, where are you? And I know there's a lot of different ways, but if you could picture one, where would you be?
I don't know how many of these would classify as great, okay? But I can tell you where a good majority of my ideas come from. I'm a big walker. I'm a 10,000 step a day guy, at least. The headset that I'm wearing right now is the same headset that I use when I'm circling the neighborhood.
Yeah.
And I will put this on, noise-canceling headphones. I'm out there. The sun is shining. I'm taking steps. And I spend the first 15 minutes just to kind of get centered. And then I just let what comes to me come to me. And I find that if I'm doing that 3 or 4 times a week, I generally come back from those walks with, hey, I should look into, or, hey, this is something that we should look into. And I come back and I've got a board that we call the parking lot. And all of these ideas make their way into the parking lot. And then we discuss them as a team and say, hey, what about this one? Or, hey, can this dog hunt? Not everything makes the cut. Not everything's a great idea. But the majority of my ideas come when I have that alone time. I'm a introvert by nature. I'm comfortable alone. I'm comfortable by myself. Gosh, I think when you run a company, you got to get kind of used to that at times.
Yeah.
But I really do find value in that alone time. And things have changed. When I first started the company and I was much more involved in the day-to-day, that time came between 12:30 in the morning and 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, right.
The only time I wasn't getting emails and the only time I wasn't getting bombarded. So it's shifted and changed. It's now happening on those kind of long walks around Butler Lake when those ideas come to me.
No music or podcast coming through your headphones. It's silent.
Yeah, not always, but generally speaking, yeah. If I'm going for a walk, if I'm looking to get centered, if I'm looking to spend some time in there, I literally have soundscapes on my noise-canceling headphones. I generally find that just not having headphones on, you hear the lawn mowers, you hear the cars,
yeah.
You hear others, you're still not quite out there. So I put the noise-canceling on and then pick. Generally, I like my favorite sound is the fish aquarium. Just
really?
The bubble. Yeah, the bubbling of the water coming up for me is an extremely calming one.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the lawnmowers. I thought you were like a bird hater or something like that.
No, it's the landscapers that are doing it.
All right. So, Mike, we talked about what you guys need to grow and so on, and you're the second in line behind a competitor. What things are you either doing, or maybe there's some things you're doing that your customers don't really care about, but what are the hot points that they seem to like hearing, which shifts the advantage to your favor?
Yeah, we talked about it a little bit. I think in years past, pharmacies looked at reverse distribution as kind of found money. And I think they're now looking at the credits that are coming in as a necessary part of running a pharmacy profitably. And so a big piece of that comes down to where's the dollars, where is the money, and how can you prove that it's coming back? And We've done a lot of analysis of our competitors and done a lot of analysis of the industry as a whole. And what we basically learned is that about 60% of credits are going to come through no matter what reverse distributor you use without a lot of effort. Okay. So you can pretty much, and this includes us, you can put us all in a hat, you're going to get 60% of it. But what that means is 40% of the credits are not going to come back unless there's a dedicated effort to reconcile those credits and to chase those credits down and to work manufacturers and wholesalers to deploy those credits. And that's really where we separate from the competition. Anybody on the front side can say, hey, look, we say you're going to get back $1,000, and just about everybody will get you back $600. But we work hard to get you back the $1,000. We have a service fee guarantee that says if we don't get you back the $1,000, we're going to refund our service fee on the amount that we haven't done. We don't have a competitor that does the same thing. And this is the delicate balance that we strive to reach with our trading partners, wholesalers, and manufacturers.
Mike, you guys come into your Monday morning meeting, you and the team. And for some reason, we'll make it a positive reason, but for some reason, you're no longer associated with medical. No pharmacy, no medical, no government, this and that. What industry would you talk to your team about and say, all right, guys, let's go?
Again, a great question. And I would tell you it would be the same industry. It just would be non-pharmaceutical. We would stay in reverse distribution.
What company is that? What kind of things?
Anything you buy online, give a thought to it. So I don't know about you, but if I'm going to buy a pair of shoes from Zappos, I'm going to buy an 11 and a half, a 12, and a 12 and a half, which automatically means that I'm going to be returning two boxes of shoes. And the entire process of handling online returns from those types of fulfillment centers has skyrocketed. It was already increasing pre-COVID. It increased significantly during COVID. Companies like Amazon struggle with this from multiple components. They get to the point, as an example, they deal with it on multiple fronts, to the point of if there are customers that they have that are generating too many returns, those customers get blacklisted. They have challenges with ensuring that the same product that's being returned is the same product that was sold. Sometimes the cost of returning that item is higher than the cost of doing the return, so they just tell you to keep it. These types of things, the reverse distribution on hard and soft goods on the front end of a pharmacy as opposed to the back end of a pharmacy, is exactly the area that we would play in. I'm not tipping my hand here, but I will tell you that that's in the parking lot.
Boy, it was today or yesterday I read about Amazon starting to put a buck on something, like just to get people to think about it. I know there was more to the article, but it was something about a dollar they were going to start doing because of this reason.
Well, you got it. You know, the benefit to the consumer has been, and the benefit to the retailer has been, free return goods. You buy it from us, you can return it without issue. But there is a real and significant cost to processing return goods. And manufacturers and fulfillment houses like Amazon are looking for ways to minimize that cost. And to your point, just putting some dollar amount on it as opposed to free is enough to change the buying patterns for customers.
I feel bad with Amazon because I'll send something back, let's say a router extender for my computer or something. I'll send it back and I'm like, I feel bad for them. Not bad enough for me to keep it and not return it, but I'm thinking right. of all the stuff that I've caused.
Yeah. Well, and if you think about it then too, and get involved in the environmental component of it, a lot of this product can't be resold. A lot of it doesn't get redistributed. And so a lot of it ends up in landfill. There is opportunity, and this is the difference between pharmaceutical reverse distribution and hard and soft goods reverse distribution. A lot of times you can find aftermarket for products like that, right? You can take a gift basket that gets returned and break it down, and the CD can go in one component and the chocolate can go in another component, and you can find aftermarket for that. Pharmaceutical is the end of the line. So there's a lot of that that goes on, but it's a really important and ever-increasing portion of our economy is reverse distribution.
And they're doing crazy things. I know they've got these Gaylords of boxes, you know, where the returns come back and they like sell this to people.
Yeah.
And part
yeah.
of the reason for selling it is just to get it the hell out of their warehouse to save
space.
You got it.
So that is where we would play. You know, we also think you posed the question, you know, it was non-pharmacy and non-medical, but, you know, we're exploring other opportunities to find ways to help our customers better handle their expired inventory on the medical side, the med-surg side, other ways as well.
All right, Mike, now you wake up and you don't have your team and you don't have your assets of the business. You've got your skill, you have your history, no team, no building. What is your next step?
Well, personally speaking, I turned 54. I have an 18-year-old senior who is my last at home. And so my wife and I will be empty nesters at the end of this year. And so those questions are coming. Those questions are real, right? And what does that next step look like? I personally have a passion for golf. I couldn't golf 7 days a week. I love it. What I would tell you is I enjoy business strategy. I enjoy the science of business. And so for me, I've worked hard over 27 years and I'm fortunate. I don't work for money anymore. I continue to work because I enjoy what I do.
Yep.
And so I wouldn't have to go get a job, but what I would do is find advisory board positions and try to find people in a position that I was in when I started this company 27 years ago.
Yeah.
Because I was so devoid of any knowledge of what I was in for that if I could have been around more of those individuals, I would have got it. So it's kind of a way for me to both give back and keep my competitive business juices flowing. I would find the opportunity to be part of advisory boards and help young companies and young entrepreneurs navigate the kind of next 5, 10, 15 years of their career path.
Well, Mike, golly, thanks for your time. Thanks for giving us a glimpse behind the scenes, which once the box gets out of our place, we don't give a damn about it. And so it's cool to see what's going on in your world. So thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, Mike, it's been a pleasure. I appreciate the time that we spent together. Really enjoyed the time and really enjoyed the engaging conversation. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks, Mike. We'll keep in touch.
You've been listening to the Business of Pharmacy podcast with me, your host, Mike Kelzer. Please subscribe for all future episodes.